Hi, and welcome to the Vocal Fries podcast, a podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Carrie Gillen.
And I'm Megan Figueroa. And hi.
Hi.
You know those articles that say 8 words in German that don't have a translation in English?
Hey, I've noticed that they've stopped saying that.
Oh, what do they, how do they say it now?
Well, now they say that are like difficult to translate or like, or I can't remember, but it's like, they've changed the wording into a more accurate statement, and I am so happy because that used to be one of my biggest pet peeves.
Oh, well, okay. So, well, this is perfect that you've noticed that because I saw someone share one of those things, and maybe I just didn't see that like slight change because I've been thinking about linguistic determinism and linguistic relativity, aka Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which we've talked about, I think, before, but the idea that the strong version, like linguistic determinism, means that language determines cognition. The languages that a person has reflects their cognitive ability, basically, or what they conceptualize.
Not reflects, determines.
Determines, yes. Sorry. Yes, absolutely.
Because like reflects would actually be closer to real, right?
Right. So maybe that's like more or less linguistic relativity, right? Would you say that?
I don't know. I mean, there's a strong Sapir-Whorf or strong linguistic relativity and a weak Sapir-Whorf or a weak linguistic relativity. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I guess a weaker one would be closer to saying reflects. But I just feel like reflects, like, yeah, if you have these categories in your head, then your language could reflect that, right? I don't know. That just doesn't feel as wrong as determines.
Yeah. No. Yeah, determines. So the reason I bring it up is because I just read this book by Rebecca Solnit, Orwell's Roses. So I've been thinking about 1984 and Newspeak. And so I was wondering if, I mean, I think, so Newspeak is basically, 1984 is linguistic determinism, right? Newspeak is linguistic determinism. People can't complain about what the state is doing if they don't have, if the only language they have is Newspeak, and since the language they have determines their cognition, they don't know that they have it bad, basically.
Right. Yes.
So like, I was just wondering, I was like thinking, I wonder if he actually, if he basically was poking fun at Sapir-Whorf, at that idea, or if he believed that.
I think he believed it.
Do you? That's the question I was having.
Okay, I'd have to reread it. I haven't read it since I was a teenager because it was one of the things you had to read in high school. But so I haven't read it as an adult.
Right.
But as I understand it, like he's making the claim that you can't escape your thought patterns if you have Newspeak.
Right. And yeah, absolutely. But I wonder if like real, like George Orwell outside of the page believed that's.
Well, I mean, how would you write that novel if you didn't believe that they could work that way?
I don't know. I think a linguist right now could do it as social commentary.
Wouldn't a linguist write it differently, though?
Yeah, you're right.
Because it wouldn't have the effect that we think it would. Yeah. Or that it wouldn't have the effect that it does in the novel.
Huh. I wanted to talk about this because I was thinking about how I bet there's so many people that listen to our podcast that are just avid readers. So if anyone has like any idea, like any thoughts about 1984 or like Newspeak or just this idea, I would love to hear them. But I've just been thinking about this for the past week because, again, I'm glad that you noticed that the headlines are changing where it's like difficult to translate, but I still see these listicles like once a week at least.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
It's interesting because like, yeah, the last 3 or 4 that I've seen from legitimate outlets mm-hmm. have been better worded.
Mental Floss, I think, is really good about it. They've changed because they have like lexicographers. They have language people.
Yeah, I'm talking about like, you know, CBC, BBC. I can't remember. But like, you know, the sort of the major media outlets of different countries.
Well, I wonder, just the idea that they're still doing these things, even if they've changed the headline, is it still playing into the whole idea?
Well, because the ones that I've seen recently, because they've reframed them as, hey, here's some interesting things that you can say in these other languages, it's less deterministic. just the way that it's worded, everything about it, all the framing is just not as, it's just more like, isn't this cool? Isn't language cool? Which I heartily endorse.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
But the old ones, or the ones that maybe still exist, but are just like, I haven't seen them recently, they drive me crazy because, yeah, it does sort of feel like if you don't have a word for something, that means that you're lacking some kind right. of cognitive ability. And it's just like, no, do you understand the concept if I explain it to you? Yes.
Yes.
Could you give it a label if you wanted to? Yes.
Exactly.
The end.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about this too, like, because one of the worst, the biggest language myth and racist myth is the idea that the Inuit have so many words for snow.
I don't know if I would call it racist exactly.
Well, the idea that they have like less cognitive ability.
No, there's no suggestion of that. It's more that they need more words for snow because they're surrounded by it.
Okay.
That's more contextual rather than racist to me. It's wrong. Or it's super right, depending on how you look at Inuit. Okay, so the Inuit languages or dialects or varieties, there's basically three or four bases, like roots, that refer to snow.
Okay.
And then you can build an infinite number of words. But just because of the way that the morphology of the language works, thousands of words based on these three or four roots.
And that's a language structure thing, not a brain morphology thing. It's a language morphology thing.
Right, yeah.
So I was thinking about this. So you said, like, if you explain something to someone, they'll understand the concept, right? I have lived in the Sonoran Desert. I grew up in Phoenix. I did not really, like, snow was not a concept that I was really thinking about or caring about until, like, it came up, right? You know, like, it doesn't mean that when, you know, for a couple of, you know, as a kid even, that I didn't have the ability to understand the concept. It was just, like, it didn't come up. It's, like,
right.
So, it's a contextual, like, the context exactly. is so important. Yeah.
Right.
So I just, like, Googled, like, through news, words difficult to translate in English, just, and there's one right here, February 21st, words in other language with no English equivalents.
See, that's good.
You like that?
That is accurate.
Okay.
There is no English equivalent, because that just means a one-to-one translation.
Right.
Correct. But they used to say untranslatable, and it's like, no, you can translate it. It's just that there is no one-to-one equivalent.
Right. But I just wonder if we've been inundated with those untranslatable things for so long that some people are just going to see this as the same thing.
Oh, probably. The only reason why I'm sensitive to it is because it's bothered me for so long. Like,
yeah.
And now that they're switching, because I think that's the first one I noticed where I was like, oh, yay! Look at them!
Well, look at this one. It says, these terms define universal feelings yet cannot be universally translated.
I mean, universally translated, I don't like that, but
right.
Yeah. But I guess, like, it depends on what you mean by universally translated, I guess.
Oh, here we go. Words in any language are usually a reflection of the local culture. They reflect emotions that are valued or experienced within that culture on a regular basis.
Correct. True.
Yeah, it's just context, context, context. It doesn't mean that you are lacking in cognitive ability. I just...
No.
I've been really thinking about that.
So here's an example that, like... It exists in English. So yeah, so if you're living in a snowy place, potentially all the different kinds of snow would matter. So maybe you do want sure. a lot of words for it.
Sure.
Even though, as I explained, it's not quite, the system in Inuit does not quite map on like that, but whatever.
Right.
It's possible. In English, how many names of dog breeds do we have?
Right.
So many. I don't know them all because I'm not a dog person. I know a lot of them, though. Like, kind of, like, against my will, I've had to learn so many of them. But anyway, so, like, some people know every single dog breed name.
Sure.
And some people only know a handful because they don't really care.
I'm thinking about Best in Show right now.
right, exactly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It's not that it's wrong, right?
Right.
We do have these kinds of things that happen. So that's why I'm like, even though the snow myth is a myth, it's not inherently a bad thing to assume that a culture would do, a language would do, because we do in English.
Right. Well, I wonder if it's like, okay, if people assume that, like, over here in Tucson, we have, like, so many different words for dirt or something.
Right, and there are lots of words for dirt in English, right?
Loam, soil. Yeah.
There's probably a lot more that I can't think of. But, like, and same with snow, too, actually. Yeah.
Sleet.
Mm-hmm. Hail, grapple, powder.
Well, isn't it helpful to have the word for sleet if you're talking about, like, be careful when you're driving?
Yeah. Also, it's, like, kind of miserable when you're walking in it. So, like, yeah, anyway.
Yeah. I have one more example that I think a lot of people, it will resonate, is Schadenfreude.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of us have heard that example of, like, that's always been on one of those lists, right? I think is that how you pronounce it?
Schadenfreude? Well, or Schadenfreude, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that doesn't make any sense anymore, because we adopted it, we borrowed it. It's an English word now.
Yeah, exactly.
But at the time, before we borrowed it, yeah, it was this concept that we fully understand, but we just didn't have a word for it in English.
And it took us a sentence to say it instead of a word, right? But that's okay. Like, what does it matter?
Right. Well, efficiency. We like to be efficient, I think.
We do.
Or, like, we think... maybe not all of us. But, like, that is something we think is cool, right? Being able to say things in the smallest amount, I think, is, like, this fun thing we like to challenge ourselves with. And so that's why we want a word versus a phrase or a sentence.
And isn't that the greatest example of how, of course, we understand the concepts, is that we borrow these words because we're like, we have this concept, we like this word for it.
Or we may not have had the concept, but now that we know it exists, we need the word. So we're just going to borrow the word.
Yeah. When one derives pleasure, joy, or self-satisfaction from learning about or witnessing the troubles, failures, or humiliations of others. I mean, isn't that sadism?
No, it's not sadism. Sadism is like you hurt someone on purpose to like get pleasure out of their pain.
Oh, okay.
Schadenfreude is just more like, oh, that person is in pain due to their own fuckery. Ha ha ha. You know, like, it's not sadistic.
What's the other one? The other is,
Masochism?
Masochism. Oh, no, that's when you're... Never mind. Okay, yeah, so we didn't have... Okay, we did not have a Schadenfreude word, I'm thinking. Now, those don't work. But yeah, I feel this all the time.
I don't like it about myself, but I do too.
Oh, yeah. I love when I see people that I can tell feel entitled to things. You know, like, mostly white dudes. You know, I'm like, meh. That's what you get, dude.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I don't really love it about myself, but I'm also like, eh. But anyway.
Well, sometimes we're petty bitches, and it's okay.
Petty
we're
bitches, humans. Salty fries.
We're humans. Yeah, we're allowed human. To be flawed.
Well, I guess people probably want to listen to our interview, but I love chatting with you about this, obviously. This is what we would do over happy hour if we're still in the same town, right?
So It's true. Yeah. So, today's episode, we talk about...
A little bit of everything, kind of?
A little bit of everything, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, enjoy.
Okay, so we're so excited today to have fellow linguist Dr. Valerie Friedland on the show to talk about her new book. Dr. Friedland is a professor in the Department of English at the University of Nevada in Reno. She has a PhD in linguistics and is an expert on the relationship between language and society. So Valerie is used to coming on podcasts. She's a public-facing linguist and often speaks and writes widely for a popular audience. And she has a language blog, Language in the Wild, which appears in Psychology Today. Her book is her first book for a popular audience, like literally Dude, Arguing for the Good and Bad English. We're so excited to have you. Thank you for coming.
Thanks. I'm truly excited to be here. I'm happy to talk to other linguists. It's always so much fun. Thank you for letting me come talk to you.
Before we started recording, you mentioned that people mispronounce Nevada. Will you talk to us a little bit about that? Because I know you also wrote about it, or you were interviewed, right, about it?
I like to joke that that's my claim to fame. I've relived that 15 minutes several times. Every time someone high profile comes to Nevada and says Nevada,
okay,
I get tapped to do some talking about the state name. But it's a really interesting thing because, you know, it's typically Western people that know how to pronounce Nevada like Nevadans do it. I grew up in the East, and there we said Nevada. I'm probably going to be given a lot of death stares in my home state now since I let that come out of my mouth. But I learned actually the day I came for my interview at University of Nevada, they warned me that it would be a deal breaker if I couldn't figure out how to say the name really fast. And so I did. And from that day forward, I have always said Nevada.
Wow.
But I've had a lot of interviews where people have said Nevada, and I don't tar and feather them or anything like that. Instead, I simply give them a lesson on the way Nevadans like to pronounce their name. And I think it's a great lesson, not just about having respect for people who are living that experience and them being able to name what they want for their state name, but also just a lesson in the fact that we have differences and they're really historically driven, and they're often driven just from weird little quirks of language. And it's an awesome point to have a conversation about. So no one needs to get mad about anybody saying Nevada, but it's a great teachable moment, as I used to say to my kids.
Well, and it's kind of a low stakes example of this, because I mean, a more high stakes example would be like someone's last name. It's very important that we at least try to get people's names correct. When it comes to people's names, that's something that, you know, is very important to respect.
Right. They're very personal. It's a very personal attribute, and the name, your personal name, but also the name of the place you live, because it's part of your social identity. And I think that's where it gets kind of tricky. And, you know, when I hear someone say Nevada, it doesn't really bother me, but I take it as an opportunity to tell them, oh, you know, in Nevada, if you actually go there, people prefer to say Nevada. And, you know, it's a fascinating history, because I don't know if you know Charles Boberg, who's a linguist at McGill University. He did a study, and it's very little known study, and it's such a great study. I'll have to find the exact title, but it was basically on loan words with the vowel that's written as A in English, that historically A words with A, usually have one of three vowels. And it's really idiosyncratic to some degree, although it does depend a little bit on time period, which vowel it uses. So there's the A vowel, the A vowel, and the other A vowel, which I'm a merger, so the A and O. So those are the three vowels. So we're going to have a lot of fun today trying to talk about vowels. Those are the three vowels that get picked up for anything written with A. And so if it was prior, I think I have to reread the article to be absolutely sure, but I'm pretty sure if it was before the 15th century, it tended to get brought in as an A. If it was after the 15th century, it tended to be an A. And this differed depending on it was Canadian or American English, which is why Canadians say pasta and Americans say pasta, because of the dating of those words. So Nevada is the same thing,
well,
I think.
Well, with the first time I heard you say pasta, I think we were at Casey Moore's in Tempe, and I was like, what is that? You know, again, like, it's not making fun of Carrie. I wasn't in that moment making fun of her. It was just like, huh, I've never heard that. I don't spend a lot of time with Canadians, I guess, or at least before Carrie. So here's like a moment for like a tiny mini lesson. I like to always point out that writing is like a social construct, an artificial thing, where language and language development is organic. And so like just this example of an orthographic in writing A representing different sounds. I mean, literacy, like reading, learning to read is very hard. It's not, you know, and this is one of the reasons why we're trying to put something like speech into writing, and it's people talk differently, pronounce things differently.
Well, and the borrowing process, like, it complicates things, right? Yeah, because it's a vowel we don't have in English, and so we have to choose from the inventory we have, and so we could go forward or we could go back in our mouth, and Anyway, I found the article. I
think. Oh, perfect.
It's in the chat if you want
to. It's a fun article. Definitely. I thought it was, you know, you don't hear it discussed that often, but those words come up a lot, words that have an A. So tomato, tomato is another perfect example of that. Vase, vase. And so I love that article because it really does a great job of explaining how we end up with these weird different layers of the way we say sounds. But, you know, just to that idea about the spelling being so distinct and really hard to represent speech sounds. I have two kids. And I remember when they were in kindergarten and first grade and they were learning words, you know, they'd have those spelling lists every Friday, which were pretty much the bane of my existence.
That is so iconic, the idea. So I had those too. Do you remember them as a child?
I think I do. I kind of blocked it out, I think. But I relived the experience with them because then you're like, oh my God, English spelling is so stupid.
Yeah,
it's awful. It's so terrible. Yeah.
It just messes. It's really hard for children. I really feel for kids, my own kids and everybody else, because we don't at all teach children why the words are so wacky in their spelling. We just are like, okay, yeah, I know meat and meat are sound the same and they're spelled differently, but just learn it, you know, and there's no rhyme or reason, but we could provide a little better explanation. But yes, I do remember their spelling words. And I do feel like I remember vaguely having them. They might've been Monday spelling words.
Yeah. Some, it's a hard to represent human language and human language variation.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's pretty recent. Literacy is surprisingly recent, the widespread literacy we have today. And, you know, even schools, in some of my work, when I was looking at Western speech, archival Western speech, we tried to find speakers that were recorded in the early 1900s that had been born in the 1800s to try to get back to what the old Western dialect was like. And, you know, one of our speakers that we ended up finding a recording, he was born in, I think, 1869. His father was actually the founder of the public school system in the state of California. So we're talking about schooling not even being that old, you know, we're that kind of thing. At that point, really, literacy wasn't very prevalent. And it's not till we have these generations of kids in school that that became widespread or even something that people aspire to. So I think we forget how really young prescriptivism in general and spelling and writing as part of what we're supposed to know being quite recent.
I appreciate you saying that just because I happened to get this 1930 copy of Sonora, Mexico census that my grandfather is in at 22. And it said that he couldn't read or write at 22. And like, I don't think that's uncommon or was uncommon.
Not at that era. Mm-mm.
And so like, that was my grandfather, you know, and my dad removed away from me that, you know, literacy was a lot different, or the idea of literacy. You and Carrie both have taught in English departments or been part of English departments as a linguist. Do you have to do a lot of myth busting? Because English departments tend to be full of, say, like undergraduates who are really proud of the fact that their grammar skills are good, or, you know, so-called grammar skills, or grammar nerds and all this.
That's a great question. You know, I have found that my experience in the English department has been wonderful. You know, I think part of it's because of where I teach. A lot of our students are first generation. And so they come with different myths, I think. And a lot of them are not so much about what's right, but worries about their own correctness. And that's what I've battled more, is the insecurities that a lot of them come to class with. A lot of them come to class with insecurities based on them not having, you know, a background of parents that had gone to college. But also a lot of them, you know, I have had a lot of students that have come with myths about who they were as sort of first generation speakers of English as well. You know, so I found that to be the harder part, is sort of getting people to believe in themselves and getting them to believe that they know what they know and they know enough, rather than that they come with these really prescriptive notions. Now, I did have a student, and I love this student. We're still very, very close friends, but she took my class. So it depends on which class you're talking about too, you know, in those notions, but she took my sociolinguistics class. And she said after the end of semester, she goes, I just want you to know, I was a real prescriptivist asshole before I met you.
Yes.
I felt like I had done my job. But she said she used to actually buy people grammar guides for Christmas if she felt like they needed it. So, you know, I took that as a win. But generally, no, I found both my colleagues and my students to be pretty engaged and interested in linguistics. I think a lot of it's because they're required to take general linguistics before they can take classes like sociolinguistics. So Before we get into sort of how language varies socially and how that's completely acceptable, and these are norms, just different norms than you have, not incorrect or bad norms, they've had to have what language structure is, how sound works, and I always incorporate some fun, you know, sounds in your life and morphosyntax in your life, so that they've learned about linguistics from a science perspective. So by the time they make it into the linguistics from a social perspective, I think they know better than to bring those prescriptivist views in with them. And I can't remember any experience I've had that has been negative in that way.
Carrie, at ASU, being such a huge public university, it had to be a little bit different, right? I mean, I also grew up in that department and got my degree. Technically, my first degree is a Bachelor's of Arts in English, parentheses linguistics, because that's how they did it at ASU.
Yeah, I think most of the undergrads were at least open to the ideas that I was telling them about, you know, language. There was like one or two who were like really hard cases who were just like really firmly believing in their prescriptivism. But it was actually the grad students that were the more problematic, because a lot of them were in the TESOL program, which is specifically teaching you, you know, how to teach English correctly. So
right. We didn't have a TESOL program, actually, in our department. It was in the education department. So I think that might have been I can see how that would have worked for sure. I will say, though, what I do find is in their papers, now that ChatGPT is going to write them, I don't know if they'll have that same effect, but in their papers, I would also often find them accidentally slipping into prescriptivist language, though, right? Where they're saying, you know, they have these attitudes that come out in their papers, but not, I think, just sort of unknowingly rather than kind of fighting with me on it.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, the worst stuff came out during either papers or the final exam, when I would ask really pointed questions about certain things. And then I was like, oh, I guess my propaganda didn't seep in, and they're stuck with the old propaganda.
Well, I all sit there and think, did you not listen to anything I said when I read those papers? Like, I really remember saying this, but okay.
Yeah, I would often get the exact opposite thing than I had actually said. And I was like, how are they misinterpreting it exactly opposite?
But exactly. Yes, yes. Oh, the joys. But I actually haven't been teaching this year because I've been on an NEH fellowship for writing and finishing the book. And I'm going back in the fall, and I'm, you know, I probably would deny this publicly, but I kind of miss it, and I'm excited to have the students back in my life.
Okay, so why did you decide to write this book, and why now?
Well, I think why now is, you know, it's sort of my pandemic baby. So, you know, I think a lot of us changed course a little bit during the pandemic and did things a little differently. So that was the timing of it, really. But this was an idea I'd had percolating for years because, you know, as you probably know, from my background, I've mainly been an academic research linguist. I've done a lot of research that has been from the National Science Foundation kind of funded angle. And, you know, no one wants to read that stuff. So, you know, my last book was called Sociophonetics. Doesn't that make you want to run out and go get it? Now, personally, it was a great book. I would suggest you go get it. But for people that are not in linguistics, it really, you
can't
read it.
Well, and in linguistics, phonetics scares me.
Well, you know, I'll send you a copy. I think this one, we baby step, because it's really written for people not in phonetics. So I'll send you a copy. Just pop me your address after the podcast. But I think the thing is, over the years, since I got tapped to do a Great Courses lecture series years ago, I have been asked to do a lot of public facing talks. And, you know, at first I thought, well, I don't really have research that works for that. But then I would go give talks about vowels, for example, regional vowels or regional speech, which was what I worked on a lot. And I would try to make it interesting from a public-facing perspective. So I talk a lot about speaker groups and how variation in language changes over time. And it would really interest people. And they would all come up afterwards and they would tell me how awesome it was. And they had never thought about language that way. And then they'd say, but could you tell people to stop saying like, because it really irritates me? Or, okay, that's great, but I hate it when people use literally, non-literally. Why do people do that? What I realized is I was actually giving them the tools to answer those questions, but in such a roundabout way, they couldn't make that connection. So all the lessons I was trying to get out about how language changes over time, who drives language change over time, why we change language over time, what kinds of voids socially and linguistically language change arises to fill, was in the talk I gave. But what I hadn't done is made it relatable to everyday speech. And these were really legitimate questions. And I realized as a linguist, a sort of academic linguist, I had shunned folk linguistics as being not really knowledgeable about language. But everyday people know a lot about language, but they just have one perspective on it. And I know a lot about language from a different perspective. And I thought, what if we tried to combine those, where we took the things that people know about language every day and then combine those with explanations and history from the things that I know every day. And we could really come up with a solution to the question of why people do X and why we hate it when people do X. So this was sort of just a percolating backroom pressure, you know, one of those things I put in the back of my mind thinking, oh, that'd be fun to do someday, you know, that someday never probably coming. And I was doing research at the time with a lot of field work. And then the pandemic hit, and I was on sabbatical actually that year to do field work. And of course, that went out the window. So I thought, maybe this is the time. I'll just write this up, never knowing what that actually meant, you know, going from being an academic research linguist to being a public facing linguist with an agent and a book deal and things like that. So it was a little more of a process than I had anticipated starting out. But I basically wrote up a proposal listing all the things people asked me about. So I thought, well, let me go at it from the angle of why do we like and what literally non-literally means and what dude means. Why do we like, right? And so I'll just break that down, use that as sort of the entry point so that people understand how those things are not just idiosyncratic kind of behaviors we have. They're actually tied to these really large, important processes about language. And then it just came together. And here I am, 2 years later, 3 years later, sitting here with the book done.
Yay. No, it's a huge accomplishment. I feel like every linguist has had like a point where they kind of realized linguistics was for them. And in your introduction, you kind of talk about how you got to linguistics. Will you share that with us here?
Oh, sure. Well, and that's kind of, it's a funny story, because I think if you had told my 10-year-old self that I was going to be a sociolinguist, I don't know that I would have taken it well.
Right. No. Yes.
You know, it's not the thing you grow up dreaming about being, although I've been very happy to have been it now that I live it. But when I, you know, I was in, my parents were actually non-native speakers. So I was actually, I'm the first natural born American in my family. And my parents had come here from various different things. My father's actually a Holocaust survivor and came from Belgium. And my mother's French Canadian. And they moved here, I think it was 6 months before I was born. So, you know, very just here. And they moved to the South, which was a different place, especially back in the day where I was born, which I will not mention how long ago, but it was long enough. Let's just say that. And, I really noticed how people reacted to their accents growing up. That was something that was really salient to me. And not just to their accents, but to the things I said from their accent. So the pieces of first generation native speaker kind of transference on certain sounds that they made, certain words that they used. And people didn't think it was cute. People laughed at me or made fun of me or mocked me. And, you know, that was really painful at that age. So it really engaged my interest in language. I think it made me wonder about the social aspects of language. Why is it that my parents are treated so differently because they're not native speakers of English? I mean, they were French speakers, so they didn't get the same kinds of discriminatory behaviors that people from different language groups can get when they come here. So my parents were sort of held as these sort of exotic, sophisticated creatures. But, you know, five-year-olds don't know that. So I wasn't exotic or sophisticated as a sort of an influenced child. Basically, what I thought is I want to study languages because my parents are so, you know, worldly. My father spoke several languages, having grown up mainly in Israel. So he also spoke French and Yiddish and Hebrew. So I thought, well, I want to study languages. I want to travel. I don't want to stay in the South. I want to travel. You know, that was my big goal as a 10-year-old, travel. So I decided to sign up to be a Chinese major at Georgetown, which is the school I went to, mainly because I thought it sounded cool, right? You know, who wants to be a Spanish or a French major? That everybody does that. I'm going to be a Chinese major without thinking, you know, how my Southern accent, which was more apparent at the time, was going to interfere with the tone system. So I thought I was doing great in Chinese class. And my drill, they called them the drill masters. My drill master did not share that attitude. And he essentially took me aside one day and said, I appreciate your effort, but you sound like you sing Chinese opera.
Is that an insult?
I think that's how he intended it. I thought, well, maybe there's a new career here I hadn't thought about. But yes, I think he meant it like, give it up, babe. You're never going to do this. What happened is I had a very Southern intonation pattern. And with the tone system, my intonation pattern and the tone system didn't really get along in such a way that it flowed. And so I think what happened is I'd be raising and lowering my voice as an intonation pattern, and it was interfering with the tonal system. And it made me sound like I was singing Chinese opera. So that made me rethink that as a career choice. And I ended up taking a linguistics class, which was required. I won't lie. I didn't take it just by choice, but I ended up in a linguistics class, and it was covering language and gender. And I just all of a sudden had my eyes open to all these things I had noticed about language, especially talking to boys, I think was really what was driving it at that age. You know, I had noticed these ways I didn't feel like we communicated right, or I felt not listened to a lot of times, or just, I don't know, those senses you get as a young person when people dismiss your speech or you're not communicating the same way. And all of a sudden, there was a reason for it. There was a linguistic, sound, scientific explanation of the way I felt. And it was really earth-shattering to me. Totally changed my view about language. And I took as many linguistics courses after that as I could. And that is sort of what set me on this path to end up going to get a linguistics degree.
It's a really cool story. I love that there was a Chinese opera.
Yes. I knew I had to have you recount it for us.
I think it worked out okay for me. Although I would say that hurt my feelings back in the day.
Well, yeah.
I understand that it is an insult, but also I'm kind of like, but opera, like, isn't that like a highfalutin thing?
It was actually a lovely insult, I think. You know, I feel like he could have said, you suck, just give it up. But instead, he did it in this really lovely way. So I thank you.
So there are so many think pieces on what's causing the downfall of society. Why do you think that language is usually pointed to as one of the culprits?
I think, you know, a lot of that has to do with intergenerational differences that become very apparent. So, you know, a lot of it is that we see these divides. I mean, any language changes occur whenever there are social fractures, essentially. And social fractures can be space, right? So regional differences or differences across different land masses and oceans. But more often, it's culture, it's gender, it's ethnicity, it's a million different things, but also age. And so I think when we look at young speakers particularly, and we notice how different they speak than we do, we see that as degradation, not evolution. And we only see this one cultural moment we live in. And these cultural moments we live in say that one thing is right and the rest of things are wrong. And that's been ingrained into us since, you know, we're probably even preschool, when parents tell us it's not him and I, right? That it's he and I. When they're teaching us these rules about, you know, structures that are really politeness, right? They're about manners, the way we think we should talk. But they are misconstrued and misinterpreted and mistaught as sort of diehard rules that you can't break. And that sets us up to see anything that varies from it as bad and wrong. And then particularly with young speakers who go out of their way to do things that are nonconformist or sort of slightly rebellious or different, that then we really notice it, I think. Or if it's a group that we tend to have stereotypes about, it's really easy to then assign them into that category of bad language that we've learned since the time we've been little exists. So I think it's a matter of, you know, just generational divides and social divides, but I also think it's a matter of the way that we teach children about language.
So I wanted to mention double modals too, because that's a very, you know, it's associated with some Southern dialects. And my mom has double modals, but I got that from her too. So like, I can say my could, you know, like that works with me. But if people were judging me based on how I speak, it might be kind of weird that I have double modals.
Well, only because I think you don't have a Southern accent. We so strongly associate that. But I grew up with double modals, and I actually think they're incredibly useful. I love a double modal. I use it. I think it's a nuance we lack in standard English. But, you know, actually, if you look at the history of double modals, they seem to be Scots-Irish. So they actually are sort of a pretty old form that probably just got retained. They were probably much more widespread across the early colonies, but ended up getting sort of slowly atrophied so that they only became a Southern feature. You know, I grew up in the South. Now, I think when you have parents that are non-native speakers, it does sometimes orient you a little differently towards peer group influence. And so I was never as strongly Southern sounding as some of my friends when I was growing up who had parents that were from the South. But I definitely had a Southern accent, which ended up, of course, derailing my career plans in college. But when I moved to Michigan to get my doctorate, I called people honey and I said y'all. And what I found was people reacted to me so strangely, and it misconstrued it a lot of times as sort of overly intimate. And what I realized, I sort of tempered that in my speech because you learn quickly that it's not rewarded in other speaking contexts. In the South, I had used it all the time. No one ever said it. I mean, just totally normal. But once I moved out of the South, I think like everybody else's experience who's kind of left the South, they then get called out for the stereotypes that we have about the South by their speech. And that's unfortunate that we do that, because I think I actually love many aspects of Southern speech. I think y'all is a beautiful way to solve pronominal problems. So
can we talk about thou and y'all and how y'all is filling a spot that's much needed?
Yes. I love, you know, English pronouns are amazing. They're so fun. They have such an amazing history. Yeah. And so I could talk for hours on that one, but I'm going to try to restrain myself and just talk about thou and you. So, you know, if people don't know the history, between the 13th and 17th century, the second person pronominal system of English drastically changed based on basically massive changes socioculturally that were happening in Britain at the time. So, you know, first we had Norman French that got brought over with William the Conqueror in 1066. Well, that introduced something called power semantics, which meant that we had to really pay attention to status and we wanted to show linguistic respect to authority. And so instead of the older pronominal system, second person pronominal system, which had been thou, thee for singular subject, object, right, with thou being subjects and that and thee being objects, and ye, you, with ye being plural subjects and you being plural objects. We then started where that was really the distinction between them. We then, around the 13th century, started using you and ye and you for status, for recognizing status and authority, and thou, thee was sort of intimacy and close relationships or for people lower in status than you were. This was a big shift because it really hadn't been used in that way. But what you do is basically if you were, you know, had a parent that was talking to you, you them because you were showing respect for authority. Parents would say thee or thou to their children. Same thing to servants or, you know, other people that you didn't think were your equals. But around, we get to around 1500, things started changing. And by the early modern period, egalitarian beliefs had really started to take over, where there was more chance for upward mobility. There was a sort of breakdown of the traditional class structure that had been really rigid up to that point. And so it became dangerous to thou somebody. And in fact, in Shakespeare, there, I think it's in Twelfth Night, there's a character that says, if thou thou'st him some thrice, it shall not be amiss, which essentially means thou that asshole, right? It means
that's awesome.
Insult him by calling him thou three times. And then, you know, we'll see how this all works out. So the idea there is it had started to be a signal of sort of calling someone out as being your socially inferior. And now in this time when you really couldn't know who was above you and who was below you in sort of social hierarchy anymore, you were going to be in trouble if you thoued the wrong person because it would be taken as an insult. So that's where we started to get rid of thou and thee, because it became sort of a marker of thinking someone was lowly And you didn't want to take that risk. So if you were going to meet someone, you would you them just to be safe, or ye them. You would ye them or you them to be safe. Now, the really interesting twist comes with the people that were standing against that were the grammarians, which were sort of, which was a fledgling thing. I mean, grammar in the sense that we think about it today and grammarian angst really didn't start till about the 1700s. But what happened is the early grammarians started to say, well, this is not correct. We need to go back to thou and thee and restore the proper pronoun paradigm. But also the Quakers found it to be against their code of plain speech, which meant that all humans were equal. There was no status because it was between you and God, not between you and others. And thou was the symbol of humility. And so by shifting to you and ye, you were actually going against God. So there was both this sort of grammarian angst and religious angst around this shift, which I think is really interesting when you consider what kind of angst we have today. There's sort of this conservative religious backlash against non-binary they. And then there's also this grammarian angst about subject-verb agreement. And the real lesson we can get is not only did you start to be used with all people and thou and thee fell by the wayside, but ye was actually the, if we're going to say correct, the correct subject pronoun, and you would have been the object pronoun. And do we ever ye people today? Well, not unless you're Kanye West, right? Right. You might be he.
Yeah, exactly.
You might be he in that context. But generally speaking, right, we say you. We say you for subjects. We say you for objects. And the reason that we probably just adopted you for both, much like we say him and I now for subjects, is because think about you and ye in fast speech. If you say ye hear ya, ya hear ya. Right? You see how that can change from ye hear you to ye hear ya to ya hear ya. And so it probably just became confusing at the time because of fast speech. They fell together, which we do all the time when we talk. But also at that time, we didn't have do support, you know, where you stick a do in for questions. So if you said, do you know that? It would be knowest thou or knowest ye that. But who keeps up with where the subject and object is when you do that kind of verb raising? Nobody, right? So now you have the ye after the no, where it should be a you. So it's really super confusing. So why not just get rid of all of it and say you all the time? If I were a grammar maven, I wouldn't like any of it, but it went through anyway, right? We did it anyway. And now all of us you, and to make matters worse, not only do we you in singular and plural, not only do we you in subject and object, we also you to everyone with a plural verb. But has anybody dropped dead? Has lightning struck any of us? Have we stopped functioning as a society because of it? No. So it's just a great lesson that pronouns have shifted all through time. They've shifted in ways that we don't like, and yet it becomes the norm and we have no problems with it. But the problem we do have with it is because we use you for singular and you for plural, and we like to be specific sometimes, we don't have a way to refer now to separate you singular and you plural. So we have to come up with inventive ways to do it, which is why you guys, for example, has become so prevalent why in mainstream speech. But you all is another wonderful form. And in fact, also a Scots-Irish form. And that seemed to have gotten shortened to y'all, which was a beautiful solution to the lack of a true second person plural pronoun. So all of it's related to Shakespeare somewhere down the line, right?
Yeah, I've picked up y'all.
I think it's become widespread. I actually think it's reaches far outside the South now. I hear a lot of people say y'all.
It does, yeah.
Because it's so handy. I mean, there are other ways, right? People say you all, you guys, yous, yuns, yins. There's tons of different ways. Obviously, it's a need. And I think that's one message that I try to get in the book is language constantly has things that we need as speakers that it doesn't have. And we create ways to do it. And y'all is a great example of how we have taken a void in the language and filled it in such really fabulous ways. And y'all is probably the best example of what the perfect plural pronoun should be.
What kind of resistance have you faced as a public-facing linguist, as we do, when we try to explain that there's nothing wrong with vocal fry And how does it relate to misogyny?
Well, and you know, that I think is so fascinating because what if we look at the history of women's talk, it's always one thing or another. And the thing doesn't matter. The process is what's important. And vocal fry is just the last on the long list of things that women have done that we don't like. And generally, they get called out for it. The fascinating thing about vocal fry is if you look at the literature, men have actually been studied for fry much longer than women. And most of the studies in the 80s, for example, pointed out that men fried more. But it was never called, I mean, we don't hear things written up in magazines about the vocal fry epidemic ruining men's job prospects. It's just one of those problems that we have that we police women's voices more. We historically have always done this. You know, this goes back to the times of Aristotle, who valued and wrote about the silent woman. And in antiquity, women's voices were not allowed in public spheres. You could lobby your husband or you could lobby a male member of your family to go and speak for you. But if you did it yourself, you were disparaged. And then this gets picked up in the medieval period where women were charged with, in the late medieval period, with sins of the tongue at a rate of almost 80% to 90% more than men. So essentially, it was an exclusively female crime. And the men that were charged with sins of the tongue were then accused of being womanly. And that was the biggest problem for them. So we have always policed women's voices more because of the danger when they are out of the domestic sphere that they pose, I think. And the other problem is not so much that it's intentional always. I think, you know, obviously we're charging someone with sins of the tongue. It's pretty intentional. But a lot of times what happens in professional workspaces, which is what I think has happened with broadcasting and vocal fry, is we have become used to a certain type of voice in that context. And in professional talk context and specifically broadcasting, higher pitch voices have not been well received. Women's voices were not heard in those domains, and therefore we don't like them as much when we hear them. And we come up with adjectives like shrill and annoying and high-pitched and screechy to describe those voices because we're not used to them in those domains. And vocal fry is a really interesting, I think, ingenious solution to women that are, because we find it a lot in broadcasting. In fact, several studies have pointed to higher use in broadcasting of vocal fry for women than in other contexts. And what do you do when someone's telling you you have too high a pitched voice? You have to lower it, right? If you're going to try to meet those needs. But then what do you do when people tell you that women with low pitched voices are not well received either? Well, what if you just used your high pitched voice and did an excursion into low pitch with vocal fry? What a brilliant solution, I think. Two stones, one vocal fry. And I think that's really what has driven a lot of this sort of movement towards vocal fry is that women, young women, increasingly see models in professional places and spaces that we didn't before. But we also see that the models that are most revered tend to have lower voices. We're told that high voices are not attractive in those professional domains. And so what's a solution to become urbane and professional sounding and also sort of hip and young? You can do this attribute that's called vocal fry. And if you actually poll young people, generally, they actually like the sound of vocal fry. I think it's just old geezers that don't really like it. And, you know, like with everything else, we just don't like what we don't know. And that's been the truth through history. What happens is when you get used to something being a certain way, things that are new and novel stand out to you. And because of women's role in sound change more generally and in language change more generally, women have often been the progenitors of new changes. So what happens when you have social stereotypes about a group already, and then that group does something that also makes them stand out? Well, it's generally not well received. So I think we have this underlying pressure on women to be novel in language, to be creative, partially because unconsciously and non-agentively, just sort of naturally, they get more sensitive to these potential embryonic linguistic forms and the opportunities they may open up if they use them for stylistic sort of fashioning of themselves. And because we already notice women's voices more, then when women's voices sound different, we call them out for it more. So it's this weird cycle of women are more creative and innovative with language, and therefore women don't get held to be a good model of speech because we notice more of these new things they're doing. So it's kind of this weird cyclical pattern that we've fallen into. And I think that's why every new feature is met that same way. I feel like vocal fry is a really understudied area. And I've actually been proposing to one of my colleagues that we do a extensive study on vocal fry where we collect a bunch of voices, because really we don't know that much about it. Like this idea that vocal fry is increasing. Well, I do suspect that it is. I actually do suspect that it is. There's no really good research that supports that it is. Actually, maybe this should be the Friedland Vocal Fry collaborative project.
Yes, sure.
That would be really cool because like I've tried to find it and this research is just not there. And if it's done, it's done by non-linguists. And I've even listened to samples that they have. And I'm like, they're saying this is a woman with vocal fry, but she's not using it, or she's not using creaky voice, which we call it in linguistics.
Right.
And this male selection they have, he's frying. So like, they're not even, it's not good data.
No,
some of it,
right. And you know, that really well-known study that was widely publicized about women's voices with vocal fry not being as hireable, I will say interesting to be kind, but it was an unusual testing situation because this stimuli was made by having someone adopt vocal fry when it wasn't natural in their voice, which I think is a lot like saying, I'm going to go talk with a British accent all day and see if people like that more or less than my normal voice. It's not going to be an accurate rendition when you adopt it in that way, because it's not organic and natural to your speech. And we noticed that. I mean, I've had a few friends that I've noticed when they would adopt a Southern sort of speech feature when they were in the South, and it would irritate me because it wasn't authentic. You know that, right? You can feel that. So I think we should do that study. Let's do it. That'll be our future project.
A few years ago, we were on a different podcast talking about all this stuff. And so I did an experiment where I was trying to watch older TV shows just to see, like, when is it that women started using vocal fry more? You know, like the 90s, women were already using it. I don't think it's maybe as much. Like, I do think people are frying more intensely now, or at least some people are. But they're still using it. And then I went back further into the 80s and I could still hear it. And then I got to one person, one character, Diane from Cheers, who didn't use it. It took me that long to find someone.
Wow.
I mean, it wasn't like a totally extensive, I didn't rewatch all the shows, but...
It's old. Yes. I mean, that's why it's been sort of tricky to measure, because I think what we're seeing is maybe some slightly different use of vocal fry that makes it more salient. And either it's just sort of this placement is different, so it's more salient because it's at the end of words versus more scattered. I don't know what the difference is, but it's something we should study because I think we need the data. Really, we don't have evidence of even time processing, like change over time. We know that young women get called out for it a lot, but there was one study that looked at middle-aged women and younger women, and there was not a significant difference in the amount of fry in their voices. So even that doesn't tell us really whether it's actually increasing, or we just believe that it is.
I strongly suspect that it's actually like there are individuals who use it a lot more than it ever has been used in the past.
I agree. Yeah.
But like generationally, it's probably not that much.
I think there's definitely something happening, but that's where we need more data to figure it out. But I actually agree with you. I think there's something different. And I actually do think it's probably more prevalent, at least in women's voices, than it was. But again, we don't have that data.
I would love to do this because I'm just so tired of these really strong claims by papers that are very misguided and not from linguists, or not to say that linguists are the only ones that can do this, but I'm kind of saying that, like, at least have a linguist with your, to look at your stimuli.
You need a linguist to make sure the data is going to be good. You do.
Right. Yeah.
And how to do the measurements so it's accurately reflected and it's similar across groups. And then the other thing is, there was another study done by a speech pathologist and a linguist that looked at a sort of review of all the studies on vocal fry. And they found that young women were the participants in those studies at a rate of 3 to 1 of any other participant. So that's the other problem, is we don't have good data on people other than young women. And so, again, we just need more research on it.
Well, even the very first study that really kicked all of this off, it was linguists, but they only looked at women's language. They had tested male students as well, but they didn't report the data. So we don't actually know if there was a difference. It was just the fact that they only talked about the women that it turned into this thing.
Right, exactly. No, I think that's exactly what that 3-to-1 ratio shows, is we've focused on young women. And part of that all ties back to this whole process we've been talking about, that young women's voices are policed more than men's. And we notice things in their speech. So we use them as their subjects. Linguists do this too, because that's where we see it. And then what happens is that sends off this message that that's the only person who does it is this young woman, or young women more generally. So we kind of, I think, help that cycle inadvertently. Yeah.
I definitely don't think it was on purpose, but I do think that that study, unfortunately, is responsible for some really bad science.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, all of these things that we've been talking about are all in your book. This is what I would call like a word nerd, language nerd's dream book. I feel like so many people are like, the dictionary, or I love grammar rules. Like, this should be, use more books from linguists as your guiding light when it comes to your word nerd, language nerd stuff. Because I think it's better for society, right? Like, do you have like a last message for our listeners?
You know, I think the big message is that we get really upset over changes in language. And what we really need to do is just step back and realize, hey, we don't sound like we're in Beowulf. And who would want to, right? So, you know, the idea that we've gone downhill, I think, no one wants to go back to the days of old English. And if we really believe that time travel in language is only to the detriment, then we really should be going back and reading all these old texts and considering whether that's what we actually want to sound like. So I think my main message would be, A, just later, dude, because that seems like appropriate here, but also just relax, enjoy it. Know that it's not going to kill anybody to adopt a new feature. And in fact, what we're saying today and what they're saying as youngsters today, our next generation, it will all work out in the end. It has done this over centuries. No one has died because of it. Well, okay, maybe a few people that called others dude in the 1800s did die out of duels. So that's not completely true. But it works out. It works itself out. It's kind of like getting your child off the pacifier. You stress about it. You're thinking, oh my God, it's going to mess them up for life. I'm going to give them horrible teeth. I've destroyed them as a parent. And it works out. You don't see 10-year-olds walking around with pacifiers, right? It works out over time. Language works out over time. So just relax and enjoy it.
Yes, relax and enjoy it. I like that.
Later, dude.
I think we leave our listeners with one final message, and this fits well too. Don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at VocalFriesPod. You can email us at VocalFriesPod@gmail.com, and our website is VocalFriesPod.com.